This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, which means we take some time to dive beneath the headlines on one of the major stories of the week. And this week, we are digging into ballot question one with an informal debate. Today's conversation is hosted by WBUR, the Boston Globe, and WCVB. And there are several ways you can follow along today, aside from listening on WBUR 90.9 FM. We're also broadcasting a video feed of today's event. You can go to WBUR.org, BostonGlobe.com, or WCVB.com to watch. Now, just as we did with question four, we reached out to the official Yes on One and No on One campaigns to book guests for today's debate. They both responded. Here representing the Yes side of question one, Andrew Farnitano, who is communications director for Yes on One, and representing the No side of question one, Dan Sensi, spokesperson for No on One. Okay, so I'm going to set the table quickly here. Question one deals with the Fair Share Amendment or the millionaire's tax. Essentially, right now, everyone in Massachusetts pays 5% income tax, no matter how much they make. A yes vote on question one would alter the state constitution to add an additional 4% tax on any income in a given year over $1 million. A no vote would keep the 5% flat tax rate we have now for everyone. So we're going to get started. And we're going to break this conversation into three categories. We're going to do some stuff on direct economic impact. We'll do some stuff on intended and unintended consequences. And then we'll do some stuff on fairness. And I'm going to try to guide us through. So if you can kind of stay in those buckets as we go along. All right. With no further ado, Andrew, first question to you. We're going to do economic impact first. The state had a surplus of more than $2 billion this past fiscal year. That's in addition to the nearly $3 billion the state will be returning in some way to taxpayers. So why do we need a new tax at all?
Relying on one-time surpluses and short-term funding is how our transportation system and our education system got in the mess that they're in. Our state has 644 structurally deficient bridges that are in need of repair. The T is forced to shut down to make what should be regular maintenance repairs. Our schools have leaky roofs and windows that don't open and class sizes that are too large. We need a long-term sustainable source of revenue to fund these things year after year, not just in economic good times, but in economic bad times. And that's what question one will help provide.
So Dan, Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center did publish a report about those 644 bridges. They were listed as structurally deficient. There are more than 200 additionally listed as in an unknown condition. This is earmarked. This is money earmarked for education, public transportation, roads, and bridges. All stuff we can use. So certainly, why not do a new tax?
Absolutely. And educational spending, transportation investment are very admirable ideas and notions, ones that we should pursue wholeheartedly. Unfortunately, this ballot amendment, were it to pass, will not increase funding in either of those tranches.
Why?
Because constitutionally, it says subject to appropriation. 2 years ago, this ballot question was thrown out by the SJC because an attempt to direct the funding and the increase funding was thrown out as not constitutional. So they came back, altered the language, and had it. This is what passed muster. But what happens, the way our Constitution was written, we have a flat tax and we have a bicameral system where the legislature decides where funding goes. It appropriates the money. And they decide by doing an assessment of the Commonwealth, where the needs are, where they're assessing where the interests are of the Commonwealth and where the funding should go. So yes, the actual dollars raised were this to be put in place would go towards education, would go towards transportation, but it would not increase funding in either of those areas $1.
It absolutely would. Look, the leaders in the legislature, Attorney General Maura Healey, have all agreed that passing question one will mean more money for education and transportation. And it's just common sense. When you look at our cities and towns, when you look at our transportation system, they all need more revenue. They all need more funding for schools and roads and bridges and public transportation. There's no other way that we're going to pay for this other than asking the middle class to pay more unless we pass question one in November.
So Andrew Farnitano, communications director for Yes on One, I'll stay with you to follow up on that. It is often a concern when policy is passed that will add money to a line, you know, to a particular cause, that what might happen is the legislature might instead replace money. Okay, so we've got $1 billion coming in on education. Great. We'll take $1 billion that we were already spending on education. Now we can spend it on something else. So where is your confidence, or how do you respond to criticism that this will just replace money? We won't see more spending on education, public transit, roads, and bridges.
The Question One campaign is backed by tens of thousands of teachers and bus drivers and other workers, public and private employees all over the state who are working hard to pass this. We wouldn't be so focused on passing this question if we didn't believe that the funding would reach the classroom and reach our roads and our public transportation system. That's why we're in this fight. We're doing this to make our tax system fairer so that the very, very rich pay a little bit more, and we're doing it to invest in transportation and education.
And we will come back to fairness a little later. I want to stay on economic impact. Turning back to you, Dan Sensi, who's a spokesperson for No on One. Evan Horowitz is the executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis, which is at Tufts University. Mm-hmm. We had him on yesterday sort of just breaking down their analysis. They did the analysis on this. Here is Evan talking about the fact that the center estimated that somewhere between 30% and 70% of the money taken in through the tax would actually lead to additional spending in those target areas. So here he is.
You can't really guarantee you're going to see additional spending. Having said that, we've looked into this, because just because you can't guarantee it doesn't mean it won't happen. And looking back at other kind of earmarks, similar cases, it does seem like kind of roughly half of this money will lead to additional spending in the targeted areas.
Okay, so if you look at a swing from 30% to 70%, right, the median, the middle part is 50%. 50% of $1.3 billion, which is their estimate for how much this would generate year over year in revenue, again, not unmeaningful. How can you be so sure it won't go where it's supposed to go?
Yeah, I mean, and that's their analysis to where that is. And the I think the operative words there are how he started it, that it won't guarantee. Let's go back to the cover of the Boston Globe last week. Legislators were asked, if this were passed, how would you spend the money? And a number of them, Chairman of Ways and Means included, said, can't guarantee anything, in great big quotes there. They assess the needs of the Commonwealth every year. And there are advocates in environmental affairs, there are advocates in social services, there are advocates in healthcare that would love to have a considerable amount of more funding to come their way as well. All noble endeavors, all things we should invest in, so all will be pulling at the pie.
What about that straight from the horse's mouth?
It's not up to them. This is a constitutional amendment. It's not a regular law that the legislature can choose to change. This is a binding constitutional amendment that could only be changed by another vote of the people. And so when we pass this in November, that restriction that the money raised must be spent on education and transportation would be binding on the legislature. They would be required to follow it.
So why is that not enough?
It's $1.2 billion, $2 billion, $900 million, whatever it is that's going to fluctuate because of the nature of the economy and how the taxes that are generated here, and capital gains and others fluctuate wildly relative to the economy. So it's not a stable gain. But also, we spent over $15 billion in these areas last year. So yes, the money will go in, but it's never going to be enough. And the monies that go in can be replaced by others. There's no question about that.
It'll be more than we have today.
It won't be, actually, not to be argumentative, Tiziana, but it there's no guarantee to that whatsoever. And as many times as you analyze it, as many times as you want to try to say that it will, there's zero guarantee, because the legislature will appropriate the monies they see fit in education. In educational spending, we are sixth in the nation right now per pupil. We're third in the nation in test scores. It's an allocation issue, I agree. We could have other schools do better across the Commonwealth, but it's not a funding issue. And the legislature will allocate the monies that they see fit, but they do not have to increase 1 cent in either of these two areas.
Okay, so that's back to the argument, and Andrew, you and I have talked about that already, about the additive, yeah. Where we know that the Center for Budget and Policy Analysis, for state policy analysis, is saying estimate 30 to 70%, and Dan, you're saying no guarantee there. So I want to hit two things here, and then we're going to move on. So first, I just want to note, it is a piece of the ballot measure that in future years, this is pegged to cost of living, which means we're starting at $1 million now. And this is just for our listeners to understand how this proposal works. Right. In future years, that number would actually, the threshold number would go up to track with cost of living. And the second thing I was looking in the Center for State Policy Analysis report. There is an argument in there that actually we will see not super consistent, but consistent revenues year over year in this. So I just want to hit those two facts for our listeners. I'm going to reset us here, and then I'm going to move us into the second subject for our debate. So you're listening to a debate on ballot question one, one of four ballot questions Massachusetts voters will weigh in on in this election cycle. Question one deals with the Fair Share Amendment or the Millionaire's Tax. A yes vote would create an additional 4% tax, but only on annual income over $1 million in a given year. And a no vote would keep the flat tax rate of 5% for everyone that we have now. Here representing the yes side of question one, Andrew Farnitano, who is a communications director for Yes on One. Representing the no side, Dan Sensi, spokesperson for No on One. Today's conversation is brought to you by WBUR, the Boston Globe, and WCVB. And in addition to listening to this debate on WBUR 90.9 FM, you can also watch a video stream. You can go to WBUR.org, BostonGlobe.com, or WCVB.com to watch. So I'm going to move us now into some questions around intended and unintended consequences. Andrew, over to you. One of the arguments that the no side has made is that this could lead to high earners either leaving the state or working the system to hide more money. And the Center for State Policy Analysis has argued more likely the latter, not a lot of people leaving the state, but a lot of people who can have the resources sheltering that money. And in fact, this $1.3 billion estimate of the revenues is a discount of $670 million because of that ability to hide the money. So any concerns about driving big money out of the state, out of the tax base, in favor of two priorities versus the whole spending of the Commonwealth?
No. The federal taxes are much higher than state taxes. If a high-income person already has an incentive to work with their accountant and reduce their taxable income, they're doing that already. There's no reason that they would do that in any additional way due to this tax. And we would be doing the same thing that many other similar states, California, New Jersey, New York, Minnesota, all have high tax rates, higher than we would have here in Massachusetts on income over $1 million. And they haven't seen these types of problems that are being threatened.
So, Dan, even with an estimate that, you know, some percentage of families do move out, there's a $670 million potential price tag of loss of revenues. On the flip side, what about this idea that economists might call positive externalities, which is you're investing in transit, transportation, education, which grows prosperity at the lower level of the tax base, turns more people potentially into high earners. Is there an argument to be made here? What's your response to the idea that this is sort of a prevention measure, right?
Yeah.
Which is to increase our prosperity overall. And if a few families leave, short-term loss for long-term gain.
Sure. So many things to unpack there. And I hate to be a broken record, but there's not going to be any increased funding in transportation or education. So the premise that that would go towards that end, I believe, is a false one. Second, we're already one of the most expensive states in the Commonwealth, in the nation, to do business. And we're losing people. The Mass Taxpayers Foundation has done studies that say we're losing upwards of $2 to $3 billion a year already each year. Given COVID, given the change in the workplace, the work from home mentality and the new structure that businesses are creating here, it's much easier for high earners to go to New Hampshire, to domicile in Florida and still keep their job or keep where they're working. But yet we'd lose the tax incentives to that, you know, back to Taxachusetts. You know, are we going to end up, is that what we want to go and want to do with this?
So I hear you on this no guarantee, but we know that legislators have prioritized pretty consistently education, especially. I mean, if you look over the last 4 to 8 years, and transportation.
Yeah.
So, yes, there's no guarantee, as you argue, there's no guarantee that they will. But that also would mean the corollary is true, that there's no guarantee that they won't either.
$10 billion coming from the infrastructure bill that President Biden just sent into transportation here in Massachusetts. Another $10 billion in surplus money. The highest stabilization fund in history, $2.94 billion in overpaid taxes coming back to the people in the Commonwealth. Now is not the right time for this tax.
So let's talk about timing. We've just heard from Dan Sensi, who's spokesperson for No on Question One. I'm turning now to Andrew Farnitano, who's the communications director for Yes on One. Today, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is holding a hearing expressing concern about our safety and management quality at the state level with the MBTA and public transportation. One of the things she argued in setting this up is there's a lot of money coming in for infrastructure and public transit. Can we be confident that the T and other parts of the State Department of Public Utilities are ready to spend that money appropriately? So what about the question of timing? Isn't there some concern that we aren't ready for another couple $1 billion influx?
Yeah. She also said that the workers at the T are under-resourced and overworked. And we are in this mess in the T because for years, opponents of the very rich paying their fair share have said, we need reform before revenue. We need a plan before we spend a single dollar. And over the last two decades, our infrastructure has continued to sink into disrepair. It's going to take more money to make things better. And we think that the very rich should pay their fair share to make those investments, not drivers paying more with the gas tax, not T riders paying more in fares, but those at the very top who have been the most successful and benefit the most from our strong economy.
Okay, and we are going to get into the fairness in a minute, but I've got two more things that I want to hit on in this area of intended and unintended consequences with the two of you. And I'm going to play a piece of sound here, again, from Evan Horowitz. I know we're going to him a lot, but he was our explainer on the show yesterday, and this is the center that did the analysis. So there has been an argument that the no side has made that this would impact one-time millionaires. So people who in a given year have some event that creates income over $1 million, but aren't year over year what we tend to think of as a millionaire. Evan argued yesterday what that might look like. Here's that sound.
You know, you're a dentist and you've built up a practice, you know, over three decades and you're ready to retire and you decide you're going to sell off the business. You're going to sell off, you know, your equipment or your client list, whatever it is. And in that year you sell this business, you may make income of $4, $5, $6 million, and you'll pay the tax in that year. Having said that, in that year, they'll pay because they will have a giant windfall.
So a question, short question to each of you. Dan Sensi, why not? It's $4, $5, $6 million. You're only going to pay it in the year that it happens. That is a lot of money. And we're talking about 4% over the million.
Sure.
So why not?
It's an 80% increase from where we are now. And I think that this will spill over when we're talking about fairness, too, as well. I think it's
we're going to go to fairness.
Yeah,
next.
No, and I think that this probably leads into it. So 50.5, over half of the people captured by this each year, it'll be the only time it happens in their life.
So 50.5, just percent?
Percent, yeah. Half of the people captured by this tax every year, it'll be unique to them. But they don't consider themselves millionaires.
So let me just stay with
that.
They
work their entire life.
One time.
One time. Correct. Is that who we're going after with this? I thought we were going after the uber wealthy. I thought we had to have people pay their fair share who don't pay enough taxes.
Okay.
This is people who've worked their entire life for one single event that will be fund their nest egg, fund their retirement, fund their children's education, whatever it's going to fund. It's going to happen once.
So what about that?
That's not true. There's no source for that 50% number. It's
actually
pulled from the Tufts report.
The analysis.
The Tufts report does not come up with that number themselves. They pull it from an anti-tax tax foundation report that based it on a period 2007 through 1997 through 2009 when we had two recessions happening in that period. So that number is out of date. It's not based in reality. More recent research shows it's only 15% of taxpayers. That's from Cristobal Young at Stanford University. And this is important. Those individuals who make in income over $1 million only once are only paying a tiny bit more. Someone who makes $1.1 million, which is a lot of money, is going to pay an extra $4,000. 90% of the money raised by question one will come from people who are making over $2 million a year. 70% of the revenue raised will come from people making over $5 million a year. Those are the super rich who will pay the most.
Okay, you're listening to a debate on ballot question one, one of four ballot questions Massachusetts voters will weigh in on this election cycle. Here we have Andrew Farnitano, Communications Director for Yes on One, and Dan Sensi, Spokesperson for No on One. Yes means We would create an additional 4% tax only on annual income over $1 million. No means we would keep the flat tax rate of 5% for everyone. Today's conversation is brought to you by WBUR, the Boston Globe, WCVB, and in addition to listening to this debate here on WBUR 90.9 FM, you can watch a video stream. You can go to WBUR.org. BostonGlobe.com or WCVB.com to watch. So, the third category, fairness. And I'm going to ask the same question to both of you. Dan, Sensi, how do you know what's fair?
How do you know what's fair? Well, that's kind of an existential question, don't you think, to that point? So,
but that's kind of where we are in the fairness argument with this initiative.
Listen, it's not for me to judge whether or not this was written appropriately or the language is correct or this is the correct vehicle. Educational funding, transportation investment are key facets to our community, to our economy. We should invest in them without question, without doubt. This amendment is fatally flawed. It captures too many people in the middle class. It's going to keep doing so for generations because it's a constitutional amendment. It will take years upon years to undo whatever is done here if we decide maybe that wasn't the right way to do it. It's going to take from the legislators what we vote for them to do and elect them to do, and I don't believe it's the right vehicle to do so. Mine and our coalition, which is made up of over 1,000 groups and individuals of farmers, of small business owners, of large business owners, of individuals across the Commonwealth, put together to oppose this language as is presented to ourselves today.
Okay, turning to Andrew Farnitano, and I want to note, you have an unfair advantage because you heard the question and Dan had to respond right away and you had 60 seconds to think about it. So I want to note that. Yeah. How do you know what's fair?
Right now, people in Massachusetts pay, virtually all of us pay more in taxes than those at the very top. That top 1%, they pay less of their income in state and local taxes than anyone else. And when you look at who's opposing this question, it's not the funding behind it is not the farmers and small business owners that Dan talks about. It is five billionaires, five of the wealthiest people in this state who are bankrolling the opposition to this question because they don't want to pay their fair share. They know what's at stake here. And we are fighting to make sure that they pay more.
Response?
Sure. Any of those folks who put in a significant amount of their personal money will tell you this is probably not going to affect their life very much in the immediacy. They're business owners here in the Commonwealth. They're concerned about their employees. They're concerned about the economy of the Commonwealth and what it's going to do. And they're concerned about the actual effects of what it will happen. And my counterpart failed to mention that they are supported mainly by two unions and union dues. And what's the ROI they're going to look to come back from this investment of over $20 million into this? I'd much rather us work together, put the $30 million spent, and find a way to really address these issues.
So I'm going to stay with the two of you. Coming back to you, Dan, with a follow, a little more sound from our conversation yesterday, breaking this down with Evan Horowitz for the Center for State Tax Policy. I'll make sure I got that state policy analysis, excuse me. And here he is talking about who's going to pay the roughly $1.3 billion that they're estimating will come from this.
Those 0.6% of households earn almost a quarter of all income in the state. So 0.6% of households earn between 20 and 25% of all the income earned by anybody in the state. And it's because of that inequality that this tax can raise any money at all from such a small pool of payers.
Is taxing a reasonable way to address inequality?
I don't believe so, because if you look across the country, those striations occur. That's just a natural state of our economy. And in Massachusetts, 50% of the residents here don't pay state income tax at all. And it's just relative to the high earners are the folks that pay the greater percentage of income tax, right? The most regressive tax is the sales tax. Or a property tax. And that's where you get a lot of the inequities and how folks pay much more of their percentage of their income tax. But we need hours to really unpack that into where we go. But that's where I come from.
Okay. And a little sound for you now, Andrew Farnitano. So taxing, creating a new tax with risk of families leaving the state, hiding money, questions of fairness as no is arguing it. Ultimately, Evan Horowitz told us that this would likely create meaningful but not transformative change. Here's that sound.
$1.3 billion is a lot of money, And if it's well targeted, it can do a lot of good on issues that people really care about, issues of educational attainment, issues of racial equity, issues around fixing our transit system. We all see what's going on with the T. What's implausible is fixing all these things with $1 billion. So a meaningful amount of money that will make a difference in people's lives if well targeted, but not a transformative amount of money.
So we're talking about amending the Constitution and changing the taxes for a small portion of our state versus something that works across the state. Is meaningful but not transformative change worth changing the state constitution?
Absolutely. We need to spend more money on these areas. I think everyone acknowledges that education and transportation need more investment. Opponents of question one want it to come from working people, paying more in sales tax or gas tax or these other regressive taxes that hit working and middle class people the most. We think those at the very, very top, that 0.6% of the population, less than 7 in every 1,000 people in our state who have been the most successful, made the most money, benefited the most from our economy, should pay a little bit more, just 4% on their second million and everything above
it. Are you arguing that it should come from working people?
This does come from working people. That's what I'm arguing. This is much more of a middle-class tax hike than ever intended. It's far more sweeping. Home sales, capital gains, we would have the highest capital gains in the country. Short-term capital gains, were this to be the case.
And remind our listeners why you argue this is not coming from working people.
I listened to Evan on the program yesterday. He agreed that home sales would not be affected. There was a study. 895 homes last year would have been affected and
right.
would pay more.
That's homes being affected. I'm sorry to argue to say
no,
that.
No, no.
It was more than 1,000 phones. It was fewer than 1,000 homes.
If you look at Zillow, where we're standing now, okay? If I were to throw a rock, every house that I would hit is worth more than $1 million.
And those would not pay more.
Regional?
Yes, they would if they're worth more than $1 million.
Okay. No, that every, is...
Stop.
That every
Everyone home. Stop, because I'm almost at the
Sorry.
End. And I was here with Evan yesterday, so here is what he argued. That anybody who realized a sale of over $1 million and were not able to offset all of those additional proceeds yes. right. would, in fact, pay more money on the sale of a house. Yeah. Yep. That was a fairly small percentage of the houses in the housing stock. And that regionally that would be disproportionate because some communities have higher housing values than others. Listen, you both have so much more to say, but we have to be done. So I'm going to start to end us now by giving you each a chance to make kind of a one-sentence final pitch. Andrew Farnitano, we'll have you go first.
This is the fairest, most progressive way to raise the revenue that we need to make investments in our schools and our roads and our transit. Not from working people in the middle class, but from the very, very top, less than 0.6% of taxpayers who would pay a little bit more on their second million and everything above it.
Okay, Dan Sensi, a couple sentences for you.
Sure. Retirees, homeowners, small business owners, farmers, all make up our coalition. All don't consider themselves millionaires. All believe this is the wrong time for this tax increase, which will not guarantee to increase funding for transportation and education.
Okay, that concludes our debate on question one, which deals with the Fair Share Amendment, also called the Millionaire's Tax. Our debate is part of our continuing political coverage this election season and is brought to you by WBUR, the Boston Globe, and WCVB. You can rewatch this entire debate, as well as our debate on question four, at WBUR.org, BostonGlobe.com, or WCVB.com. We were joined today by Andrew Farnitano, Communications Director for Yes on One, and Dan Sensi, Spokesperson for No on One. Andrew, Dan, thank you both.
Thank you.
Great to have you both. And folks, don't forget to vote on November 8th. Major League Baseball's divisional playoff series began on Tuesday, though not at Fenway Park. The Red Sox season ended last week with a last-place finish in the American League East. Local author Ted Flanagan knows a thing or two about losing. A few years ago, he helped coach his 12-year-old twin son's Little League team when they were invited to a national all-star tournament. Didn't go well. The team lost early and often. But the experience reminded Ted and his boys that there is more than one way to win.
Even in July, the nights in Milford, New York, a small town at the base of the Adirondacks, are humid and cool. I know this because a few summers ago, I sat on a picnic table outside a cabin wondering if I had officially ruined baseball for the dozen boys sleeping peacefully inside. Milford is just a few miles from baseball's spiritual home, Cooperstown, New York. We'd gone there to play in a tournament with 103 other teams from around the country, and I was in the midst of leading our team to 104th place. It hadn't occurred to me we could end up coming in dead last. It turns out there's a subculture of ultra-competitive 12 and 13-year-old baseball. The boys on the other squads have the bodies of college players and the skills to match. They play in larger fields than standard Little League dimensions and travel the country and the world because that's the only way they can find teams good enough to play them. We watched a team from Pennsylvania, the eventual tournament champions, play a game. Those kids hit line drives off the wooden walls of the outfield so hard they resounded like rifle shots. We lost game after game, but our boys celebrated hits and the occasional run with exuberance. And we always looked ahead, always ahead, to the next game, where the score would be 0-0, at least for a bit. For the week, we asked the boys on our team to ignore the scoreboard, to play for each other and their families in the stands, to give everything they had simply because it was the right thing to do. We told them that there would be plenty of winning in each of their lives, that character is revealed when times are tough, and that we were proud of them. As coaches, what we were really saying was, we're sorry we let you down. But the boys responded. They never hung their heads or threw their gloves, and other teams noticed. After we lost our sole playoff game, several teams formed a gauntlet to applaud the boys as they left the field. A team from Illinois came to our cabin dressed in their spikes and baseball pants after they were eliminated to invite our boys to have pizza with them. One night near the end of the week, long after we were out of contention, I watched a 12-year-old with Bryce Harper's hulking build and Ricky Henderson's speed take off for home on a pass ball. In one motion, he slid across home plate, popped to his feet, spun in midair, and then trotted back to the dugout. It was a perfect expression of power, speed, and grace, executed by a young man clearly born to play the game with a skill most of us will never possess. Beyond the right field wall, on a small bluff, I could see a grassy area bathed in the sun's waning orange light. And there they were, my boys. They played wiffle ball, wheeling and spinning around each other like seagulls. In and out of the shadows and bright light, their laughter was clear from 100 yards away. Maybe they came in last, but they belonged here too. The boys reminded me that there is still joy to be had in picking up the lance and jousting at windmills.
Ted Flanagan is an author and longtime contributor to Cognoscenti, WBUR's Ideas and Opinion page, which is celebrating its 10th anniversary this fall. And you can read his essay and many more at WBUR.org. So that's Sonny Stitt with the song Flying Home, Flying Home, at the Hi-Hat in Boston, 1954. There was a time when the hi-hat was the high point of jazz performance in Boston, and there was a time when it was all white, except for the workers. Then came Wally's. In 1947, Joseph L. Walcott opened the club. It quickly became famous among black musicians and patrons. If you were Dizzy Gillespie or Cannonball Adderley, you played Wally's. The hi-hat noticed and eventually changed its admission policies. Now, the hi-hat eventually closed, but Wally's didn't, even after a pandemic shutdown. In fact, the nearly 80-year-old club just reopened its doors for live audiences for the first time since 2020. And in this installment of The Business of Boston, we are looking at what you can hear at Wally's this weekend and 7 days a week. Frank Poindexter is the general manager, part owner of Wally's Cafe Jazz Club. Frank, welcome back.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
When we last talked to you, September of 2020, you were worried about lost revenue for 6 months, thinking about how to make it through. How does it feel to be open?
Oh, man, we're so pleased to be back open. It's been a long 2.5 years. And, I mean, it really makes you appreciate, you know, being able to do what you do, meeting the young musicians, great customers, and just providing a really good service to the city of Boston and the surrounding New England community.
So there's so much I want to talk to you about with you in this time, and I want to do a little history first. So your grandfather was Joseph Wally Walcott, who opened Wally's. You, your two siblings, your mom, Eleanor, now run it. What is your earliest memory of Wally's?
Well, my earliest memory of Wally's is actually across the street in our original location, and that would be working in the basement with my grandfather, Mr. Walcott, and we used to have to sort the beer bottles so that they could be returned back to the companies.
How old were you?
Probably like about six or seven years old.
And you're sorting beer bottles in the basement.
Exactly.
I bet there were a lot of them.
A lot of them, exactly. It was a lot bigger venue back then.
And have you worked basically at Wally's ever since?
Yeah, ever since. That's basically what I've done. I mean, I've had a few odd and end jobs, but for the most part, since I left school in 84, I've been in Wally's.
All right. So producer Amanda Beeland put a lot of love into getting lots of music to kind of situate us in this world of jazz in Boston. We couldn't find early recordings from Wally's, although we know many of the jazz greats came through. So we've got some sound from other places. So here is Artie Shaw, his orchestra. This is at the Ritz in Boston with the song Comes Love. So that's 1939 when that song came out.
Yes.
When your grandfather opens Wally's, jazz is being generated, pushed forward by black musicians, but it is white patrons who are going to see it. And was it a crazy, segment we heard talking about tilting at windmills. Did people think he was tilting at windmills when he opened Wally's?
Well, he did. But, you know, fortunately, my grandfather, who was a Barbadian immigrant, had a diverse network. And so with the help of Gabriel Piemonte, he was an attorney, but he was the longest serving Boston City Council president. And also with the help of Mayor Curley, he was able to become one of the first African Americans to get a liquor license in the state of Massachusetts. So, you know, he had a diverse network. And also he was able to secure a lot of talent from New York and through the whole Chitlin circuit, which many African-American musicians had to, use that network in order to get gigs up and down the East Coast and on the West Coast. And so with the help of Ed Smalls, who was a famous bar owner in Harlem, and his connections, just throughout Harlem, through that whole African-American, business network, he was able to secure talent. And so, from there, he was able to open the club, and one of my primary things he did was enable that we could integrate the clubs in Boston, in New England, was he went to the colleges. So Harvard, Boston University, Boston College, and the other surrounding colleges, and he advertised. And so those young people were the impetus of, the integration of the surrounding black community, and then the young kids, who enjoy jazz. And so that helped integrate the nightclub scene in Boston.
So let's hear a little more of this is 1954. This is from Storyville Nightclub in Boston. This is Lee Konitz, jazz saxophonist, If I Had You. So I've come to love jazz over the last few years, but a lot of people still don't understand in the 30s, 40s, 50s what an engine of creativity jazz was. Listen to this and talk about this the creativity of that era.
Again, something, what it really comes down to is you're taking an inanimate object and you're making that inanimate object do something that is creative. It's different than, using, electronic instruments and stuff like that. You really had to actually practice for hours and hours and days and days in order to be able to master, these instruments. And the other thing was that those skills were, they're transferable. So, the level of focus, You know, it's like nowadays you see our young people, they may have a short attention spans and stuff like that. But, you know, in those times you had to read. You had to read books, you know what I'm saying? We weren't able to look at screens. You didn't have the enormous amount of information which can distract children. So, distract people, children or whoever, you know what I'm saying? So
distracts me sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know what I'm saying? You really you had to focus, and it was really about mastery of whatever you're doing, you know what I'm saying? And
speaking of mastery, you've been in Wally's since you were 6 or 7 years old.
Yes.
What's the most remarkable performance you've ever seen there?
Roy Hargrove. Passed away about maybe 3 or 4 years ago, but some people are just blessed with certain, innate talents. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I equate it to basketball. If you're seeing Kobe Bryant play basketball, or Larry Bird, Bill Russell, some people have these innate talents that they're born with, and then they are able to, work their craft and master their craft. And so when I was able to see Roy Hargrove play, we usually get students, but he had already had a mastery of his instrument. And he was able to do things with the instrument that ordinary people couldn't do.
Trumpet player.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, all right. So last year, Boston Magazine put together an oral history of Wally's. Here's what Boston jazz historian Richard Vaca said about the club. Quote, "When Wally's opened, there were already 2 jazz clubs on that block, but both were owned by white guys. So I think it was really important from a neighborhood point of view, maybe from a pride point of view, that here was the first time that a nightclub in New England was owned and operated by a black guy. This was finally a place where people could get together and relax without having to worry about admissions criteria or any of that kind of stuff. In other words, they could be served." So I'm going to put that in some perspective, right? We've talked about a few of the different jazz clubs. We took the Ritz, the Hi-Hat. Here's a little bit of sound from a jazz club in Peabody, March 1971. It's Miles Davis at Lenny's on the Turnpike. And we actually couldn't find the name of the song, but here it is. Okay, and for people who don't know, Miles Davis in the 70s was a very different kind of musician than Miles Davis in the, earlier decades.
That's right.
But many of these places are gone. Wally's isn't, which means that given its start, how have you stayed so relevant, especially where jazz has gone less mainstream over time?
Well, the first thing is that we as a family business, we're committed to what we do, and we're committed to our grandfather's legacy. And then the other thing is that, we're in Boston, and our location is centrally located 2 blocks south of Boston Symphony Hall. But the most important thing is that we are surrounded by some of the greatest institutions for training musicians. So you have New England Conservatory, you got Boston Conservatory, you got Berklee College of Music, Harvard University, Boston University, Northeastern University. So in terms of training musicians, this is a special location. You really don't get this any other place. In New York, you have Juilliard, the New School. But any other place on the planet, this is it. So we're getting, at this time, due to Berklee primarily, you're getting the most talented young people from across the globe coming here to train to be musicians. And they not just musicians, they could be sound engineers, they could be songwriters, they could be just studying music business, but you're getting the most talented people on the planet, young people. And the network that, primarily through Berklee that has grown, it touches every part of the music industry. And so we're fortunate to be able to have a forum where these young people can practice and perfect their craft.
So I just have to notice that we have a Berklee graduate sound engineer behind the board in our control room today.
That's
right. Hey, Michaela, so to your point. All right, so that does bring us to today. So you had to shut down. Everybody had to shut down.
That's right.
You were waiting to kind of figure out whether phase 4 with limited attendance was going to allow you to open back up. You wound up going virtual, streaming performances.
Yes.
Was it enough to stay alive, or have you had to work miracles to
keep
things going?
Well, the thing is that, due to the help of the federal government, they, implemented different plans. So we were able to participate in the Save Our Venues grant. We also were helped by the MGCC, which is a organization in Massachusetts, and through state and local helps. And I was also did a GoFundMe campaign. So through all of that assistance, we were able to maintain our business and then be able to reopen, you know, at an appropriate time. See, since we had such a small location, you had to be careful of the fluctuants coming out of all the instruments. So we were in a unique position. So we couldn't really just open up because we would have exposed our customers to possibly catching COVID.
And because we're talking about wind instruments.
Yes, exactly. And so the most important thing for us is the safety of our customers and the safety of, you know,
So let's play a little bit here. This is from one of the virtual performances. So this is Armir Lee Quintet. This is 2021. And again, we don't have the name of the song on this one, but it is from your streaming. So is this part of the future of Wally's? Will streaming performances always be what you do now in
Well,
the park?
We are really ready to work that program due to the, you know, nature of our customer base and the young musicians. See, we got teams of musicians from all across the planet. We got the European kids from France, Germany, England, Italy. Then we got our Middle East teams from Israel and the surrounding countries. And then we got our Asian acts, you know, Asian musicians from North Korea, South Korea, China, Japan. And so, you know, again, because Berklee's bringing in students from across the planet, you know, we're able to help these kids develop their craft. And then their supporters and their family members want to see them be able to perform and grow as musicians. So we're through the help of YouTube, and specifically Ted Katzenberger, who's he has the independent venue music association within YouTube. They donated equipment to us, and so we're working now to implement that whole thing so we can, you know, stream music, because we have 3 bands a day. And, you know, we want to make some exposure for these young people.
Let's talk about that. We've got about a minute left, and we are speaking with Frank Poindexter, who's the general manager and a co-owner of Wally's Cafe Jazz Club here. You've got a 7-day-a-week schedule.
Exactly.
3 bands a day. So you've got Monday blues, Tuesday, Wednesday funk, Thursday Latin jazz, salsa, Friday, Saturday jazz, Sunday back to funk.
Yes.
Do we have that many musicians to play in Boston?
We got more than enough musicians. I mean, it's so many musicians and so many people trying to develop their craft that we don't even have enough slots in order to be able to, you know, help these young people who want to, you know, work on their craft. So, I mean, again, this is one of the most important locations for training musicians on the planet Earth, okay? And so the number of musicians we have here, it's innumerable, and you know, these young people are just working on their craft. So, I mean, we wish we had more slots.
So what time does Wally's open today?
Today we open at 5 p.m.
And where can people find out more information?
Oh, man, www.wallyscafe.com.
All right, Frank Poindexter is general manager and one of the owners of Wally's Cafe Jazz Club in the South End, a business of Boston that's been with us since 1947. Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Did you like this edition of Business of Boston? We'll be bringing it to you every other week. So if you have suggestions, tell us through our texting club. Get started by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.